Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, presenting the annual Chili Roast starting August 15th on Fridays, Saturdays, and Labor Day, featuring roasted chilies and prepared chili dishes. More at harmonsgrocery.com.
I should mention before we get started here, this is a show that deals with child sex abuse, so it might not be for everyone. Back in 2023, the step-granddaughter of Utah Senate President Stuart Adams, who was 18 years old, was charged with two counts of child rape and two counts of child sodomy for having sex with an eighth grader, a 13-year-old. That's four counts. All of them were first-degree felonies. And it meant Senator Adams' granddaughter, who was still in high school at the time of the crime, faced a possible sentence of 25 years to life and a lifetime of being on a sex offender registry. A few weeks ago, the Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke published a story that revealed Senator Adams had approached a colleague, Republican Senator Kirk Cullimore, during the 2024 legislative session. Cullimore was the sponsor of this sprawling bill with the prosaic title Criminal Justice Modifications. It fine-tuned this long list of criminal sentences. And Gerke learned that Adams told Cullimore about his granddaughter's predicament just as a plea arrangement was being worked out. He told Cullimore the law seemed overly harsh, and he asked him to, as he put it, look into it. This week, Gerke talked to us about how he uncovered the story.
It kind of arose just in a conversation I was having a few months ago. We were talking about a controversy that had arisen down in Moab, where there was a judge down there who had sentenced somebody to probation for having child sexual abuse material on his phone. And there was outrage among the legislature for that. Speaker Schultz, Carrie Ann Lisenby were throwing around the word impeachment. They wanted to investigate this. And this individual just mentioned in passing that, you know, look what they did for Senate President Stuart Adams. They changed a law to help Stuart's relative get out of a child sex case. You know, after I picked my jaw up off the floor, I started digging into it. And once I was able to identify the court case, I recognized that the sponsor of the bill was Senator Kirk Cullimore. I went back and read this 50-page bill, and there was this provision that says, in instances where an 18-year-old who is still in high school has sexual relations with a 12-year-old or 13-year-old, it was down to 12-year-old in the original bill, it's a third-degree felony. It lowered it from a first-degree felony. Pretty big drop. Then I interviewed Senator Cullimore, and he told me that the president confided in him about the situation, so he reached out to some defense attorneys, including Kara Tangaro. And I said, wait a second, you talked to the defense attorney for the individual who's related to Stuart? And he said, yeah. She identified in the statute where he could make the change, provided suggestions, helped draft the bill. That part was probably the most extraordinary thing. I didn't know that going into that discussion, and he kind of volunteered that information. You know, to be fair, Kara Tangaro is a very well-respected defense attorney and has consulted or advised or provided input on criminal legislation before. So that's not extraordinary that she would necessarily provide input. I think it is extraordinary that she would provide input on a statute that affects a case that she's handling and then use that statute to argue for a more lenient sentence for her client. And then we went to Senate President Stuart Adams, and he was very much opposed to us doing this story, period. You know, he obviously didn't want his relative exposed publicly for this. He said that this relative of his had made a serious mistake, had been punished for it, felt remorse for it. He said that from his perspective, he saw something that was wrong in the law that was unfair and unjust, and he decided to fix it. He didn't pressure other senators to vote for the bill or against the bill. They didn't even know that he had an involvement in this particular provision. He let it run its course. But he also set these dominoes in motion that ultimately ended with this more lenient sentence than what prosecutors were insisting upon at that point. And we felt like this is an important story to look at how people in positions of power, like Senate President Stuart Adams, like Senate Majority Leader Kurt Cullimore, can use that power to help individuals who are close to them. Almost 30 years in this business, this was the hardest story from an ethical standpoint that I've ever done. You're dealing with young people. You have a 13-year-old victim who obviously is first and foremost, we don't want to do harm there. You have an 18-year-old perpetrator who is a young person. People may disagree, but I don't consider that to be the same as if a 40-year-old was having sex with a 13-year-old. And we tried to handle it very carefully. I mean, the relationship, the ages, the genders of the individuals involved, all of that's come out, but we made a conscious decision to try to insulate the parties involved. Because really, the story in our eyes was not about this 18-year-old and 13-year-old engaging in sex. It was about the political side of it, where the Senate president intervened and led to this outcome in this criminal case.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Robert Gerke's revelation about Senator Adams has sparked a public backlash that Adams abused his power and his influence to benefit a relative. There have been some calls for his resignation. There's been a protest, a few letter-writing campaigns. We reached out to the senator and invited him to join us. We also invited Senator Cullimore on the show. They said they didn't have time this week to talk to us, but they have been responding to questions raised in the story. Adams has said he did not request the legislation. He said he didn't intervene in the process or give input. He says he didn't even vote on that particular amendment. He has said the bill, including the change, had broad bipartisan support, and that, anyway, the controversial change wasn't retroactive, so it didn't affect the outcome of his granddaughter's case. Now, that part is more complicated, as we'll hear. In fact, let's go back to Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. I want to begin with the difficulty involved in discussing some of the particulars of this story, at least as far as the policy of the Salt Lake Tribune is concerned. Mm-hmm. The way we're going to be handling it here at Radio West is going to be a little bit different. But can we just talk about that limitation that you have? You keep referring to a relative.
Yeah.
Explain why you're doing that.
We typically don't report on this sort of crime.
Yeah. It
has to be pretty extraordinary for us to do that. And so we didn't approach this as this individual crime or this individual who had committed the crime wasn't the story to us.
Yeah.
And so because of that, because we were concerned about the emotional well-being of both parties involved in mm-hmm. this, but particularly the victim, and because we wanted to insulate the victim from potentially being identified as much as we possibly could, we decided that we would refer to this individual as a relative, but we weren't going to identify which relative it is. It could be a nephew, a niece, a granddaughter, grandson, uncle, aunt. We weren't going to go there.
You wanted to be as vague as possible.
We wanted to be as vague as possible because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter really. It's a relative who President Adams used his influence to try to help out.
Somebody close to him.
And
that is
the essence of it.
Yeah.
So we felt like it didn't really matter. And we wanted to provide, like I said, as much insulation for the victim and the victim's family as we possibly could. We felt like we could tell the story the way it needed to be told without that piece of information in it. Now, it's come out and it's been splashed around and mm-hmm. it's salacious and it creates a little bit of a buzz. But at the end of the day, I think we made the right choice. And we consulted with national media ethicists. We had mm-hmm. intense internal discussions about this. We went back and forth a little bit on it, but I feel good about where we ended up.
Senator Adams is looking at this law. Now, he's looking at it, he's paying attention to it because a relative of his mm-hmm. is involved.
Yeah.
And he says, this is harsh. Mm-hmm. This doesn't seem right. What does he mean by that? Like, what is he seeing? Explain what the law was.
Yeah. So we had in the law a bright line.
Yeah.
Once you're 18, you're an adult, and children under the age of 14 cannot consent to sex with an adult, period.
Right.
Full stop. And so this relative had been charged with four first-degree felonies, two counts of child rape, two counts of child sodomy. for these acts committed with this 13-year-old. And I think people would look at that and go, that's pretty harsh, mm-hmm. you know. And so he felt like because there had been some leeway granted to 18-year-olds in high school who commit other crimes, mostly misdemeanors. We're talking about people who are speeding in the school parking lot during high school hours.
Yeah.
There had been some latitude granted for those. He felt like it made sense to grant the same latitude in this case where they're engaging in sex acts, but it's not – while it's not consensual because, again, a 13-year-old cannot consent under the law, it's willing is how it's referred to. And so if there's no force coercion, then it's this third-degree felony instead of the first-degree felony child rape. To be clear, he didn't go to Senator Cullimore and say, this should be the fix. He went to him and said – this is too harsh. Do you think this is appropriate? Can you look at this?
But are those two the same thing?
To be clear, I don't think Stewart told him, I want you to do this to make it a third degree felony in this section. That all came out later. He just went to him and said, look, the prosecutors are being stubborn with this plea negotiation. They're insisting on these first degree felonies. Is that appropriate? Can you look at this? And then that kind of got the ball rolling.
But when he says, can you look at this?
Yeah.
Isn't he also – he may not have set down the guidelines for how he thinks the law ought to be changed, but he's suggesting to a colleague.
Yeah.
He's the most powerful person in the Senate, mm-hmm. probably the most powerful person in the legislature.
Yeah.
And he's saying, take a look at this. Doesn't that imply – he's expecting something.
That would be my takeaway from it if he came to me. And Senator Cullimore is one of his top deputies, you know,
yeah.
and is going to try to accommodate a request from the Senate president to the best of his ability. So, yes, I was just trying to make clear that he wasn't being specific about what he wanted changed or how he wanted it changed. He was just saying – this appears to be inappropriate.
Sure. Well, this is one of the contentions that Senator Adams is making is that he didn't and we'll get to more of his contentions here in a minute. But let's talk about what happens then. So the law's changed.
Yeah.
That few lines in this, you know, nearly 50-page bill, it gets changed. The law is now changed. So you have that bright line before mm-hmm. of 18 years old. What happens to that line and what is the law now?
Well, so now if you're 18 years old and in high school, you are still treated as if you were 17. A 17-year-old would go to juvenile court. An 18-year-old in high school would still go to adult court.
Right.
But the penalty for sexual relations with a 13-year-old would still be a third-degree felony, yeah. just like it would be for a 17-year-old.
The difference is high school. You're in high school. And because of high school, what they're implying here is there are lots of social relationships here. Mm-hmm. Yes, you're technically an adult, but you're still in school.
Yeah, your brain's developing. Your peer group, you know, you have seniors in high school who hang out with 17 and 16-year-olds. How the laws address teenage sexual activity is a real challenge all across the country. This is not limited to Utah.
Right.
The bill as it was written would have covered 18-year-olds who engage in sex with 12-year-olds, which I think that's a much larger window than most states have.
What do you make of that, by the way, that they went down to 12?
Well, so
because it wouldn't be specific to the particular case of a 13-year-old?
Yeah. We have had in statute since 2017 sort of this called a punishment ladder or a graduated system where, you know, depending on the ages of the people involved, it can go anywhere from a third degree felony down to a Class C misdemeanor. You know, if it's a 15 and a 16-year-old, it's a Class C misdemeanor, right? They're both minors, but they, you know. So the 12-year-old language was in there before, so he was mirroring that. Another bill ended up taking out 12-year-olds, so now it only applies to an 18-year-old in high school with a 13-year-old. Day you graduate, you're a full adult.
Right.
You can face the first degree felony punishment.
It does raise, and you've written about this, that larger issue legal systems everywhere have to deal with. And how is a system supposed to deal with that particular case? Someone who's – they're young.
Yeah.
But they're older. They're 18. Technically, they're older. So how do you deal with the fact that this person has sex with someone who is not legally able to technically give consent?
Yeah. Yeah. It creates a real conundrum. I mean, there was a Supreme Court case in the early 2000s where a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old had sex. And the prosecutors charged them both because neither of them were legally able to consent.
Wow.
And it just kind of points to the absurdity of some of this where – and the Supreme Court threw the case out, recognized that, you know, our whole criminal justice system is premised on there being a perpetrator and a victim. And that's not the case in this instance. So there are challenging lines to draw. I mean, it's 18 and 13. Yeah. That's always been a pretty bright line in Utah code, where if there's more than a 4-year age gap and you have an adult, it is statutory rape. Mm. You know, so now is it blurring the lines a little bit? Perhaps. Is it trying to take into account the nuance? Perhaps. I mean, there is an important policy debate to be had about this, and it's one that has been ongoing for at least 8 years in this state. How do we draw the lines? What is an appropriate punishment? Who gets put on the sex offender registry?
Yeah.
In this
yeah.
particular case, that was a big sticking point. The prosecution wanted this relative put on the sex offender registry. The defense was fighting hard to not have the sex offender registry come into play. And with the change in the law, the sex offender registry is taken off the table.
Yeah.
So again, that's another way that this change impacted the outcome of this particular case. But do we put young people on the sex offender registry mm-hmm. if it means they can't go to college, they can't get an apartment,
yeah.
things like that?
It defines their lives.
It defines their life. And so, you know, and when these policies get raised, Senator Todd Weiler introduced a bill this past session to ease some of the sex offender registry requirements, and he took an amazing amount of heat for it because it's a very sensitive topic
sure.
too, because we are talking about young teenage victims. In this case, we're talking about a 13-year-old who
right.
is in eighth grade
right.
who is going to deal with the impacts of this for the rest of his life. So it's a very sensitive topic that people take very seriously, but it's also an important policy discussion and one that I don't know if you can get right. It's going to always be you know, small refinements here and there.
Let's just mention, because this is an important part of your reporting on this, the reaction of the victim's mother.
Yeah. The victim's mother didn't attend the sentencing. She said she wanted to, but she felt like they'd been dragged through this process and at every turn were, you know, not being treated fairly. She said when she found out that this law had been changed to affect this case, she felt like she'd been punched in the gut. She said she felt like this relative of President Adams was getting special treatment, that nobody was considering the well-being of her child. And it was a hard process. She said that her child has been withdrawn and depressed, didn't want to spend time with friends. There's been some real impacts to a 13-year-old child, which is yeah. significant. And you know, it's an interesting question to ask. If Stuart had been related to this 13-year-old, would have he had used his power in the same way or viewed this case differently? We'll never know that. But I think it's important whenever we're talking about situations like this, crimes like this, to maintain a focus on the well-being of the victim and make sure that they receive justice.
You spoke with Pam Vickery. She's mm-hmm. the executive director of the Utah Juvenile Defender Attorneys. And she said something to you that I wanted to sort of highlight and ask you about. She said this. She said, what the research shows is that in terms of the population, this group, mm-hmm. is developmentally, brain-wise, she said, they're at the same level of maturity as a 17-year-old. But all of a sudden, we've drawn this arbitrary line of 18. That does seem nonsensical in some ways. And the idea of them having an 18-year-old has the same sort of undeveloped plasticity in their
yeah.
brain that a 17-year-old does. So that does seem like an interesting question that you have to least contend with.
Yeah, it opens up the much larger question, right? She notes that brains aren't fully developed until age 24.
Yeah.
So should we need to have the same discussion about 19, 20, 21? You know, a lot of lines that we draw in the legal system are arbitrary. Paul Cassell, who's going to be on the program, he noted that 18 to vote is arbitrary as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could be a 14-year-old who's really interested in politics and know more about it than a 30-year-old. So should you be able to vote? 18 is kind of a catch-all for a lot of things.
Yeah.
Sign a contract, join the military, things like that. And so that has been traditionally the cutoff for adulthood and also the cutoff for statutory rape. Is it the right line? I can't say that.
Yeah.
That's what the policymakers are
right.
supposed to be doing. But it has been the traditional bright line for decades.
Cassell seems to be saying also that this can't just be based on circumstance. We just do this based on circumstance. There has to be some sort of rule, some sort of line. One of the things he said to you was, I don't think we should engage I don't think we should be getting into a debate about how mature was this 13-year-old.
Yeah. I guess fortunately in this case, it didn't really go to that.
Yeah.
But there are questions about, okay, a 13-year-old can't consent, but the law still has this willingly engages in language, which is sort of consent light, I guess. Mm. And so you do end up with discussions about, is the 13-year-old capable of making a decision like that? And it gets into a really sticky situation. And I think he's absolutely right. You know, you don't want to be putting a 13-year-old on the stand and asking that person, you know,
What did you mean by this?
Yeah. And so that's why we do have some of these bright lines. And I think he's right that from a victim standpoint, the bright lines make things a lot simpler. For administrative purposes, 18-year-old, you know, it's very clear.
Yeah.
You know, show me your ID. It's clear if you're 18 or not. 18 and in high school, now we're getting into some gray areas. But I think the argument that this involves the peer group is a valid conversation to be had. It wasn't really had in much detail during this debate on this particular bill, but it's one that sounds like we're going to have more discussion on in the upcoming session.
It's Robert Gerke. He's a politics reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. We have links to his reporting on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, presenting the annual Chili Roast starting August 15th on Fridays, Saturdays, and Labor Day, featuring roasted chilies and prepared chili dishes. More at harmonsgrocery.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going through the controversy over Utah Senate President Stuart Adams. We're talking with the reporter who broke the story, Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. Adams is being accused of using his influence to shape legislation that impacted a sexual abuse case involving his granddaughter. He says he was careful to keep his personal connection out of the process, but critics say it was an abuse of power. Now, this is a charged story because it's not just about power, but how the system should treat sexual relationships between young people who can't legally consent. Let's go back to our conversation with Robert Gerke. Let's go back to Stuart Adams and his involvement as a legislator mm-hmm. in this process. Adams says there was nothing unusual about this bill in the sense that he says they're all connected to personal experience. It's a case that Paul Cassell has made in an op-ed piece in the Tribune. He's going to be talking to us. He says, look, this is a part-time legislature. These are part-time citizens. And there's nothing wrong with them bringing their personal and community experience into looking at an issue and saying, hey, there's something screwed up about that. We should fix that. That's how everyone does it. Mm-hmm. They always bring their own personal experience into something like this. So what did he do wrong?
Well, I guess I can let listeners decide if it, what he
what
did.
Are others saying that did wrong?
Let everybody decide for themselves if it was wrong or not. And it's a perfectly valid point that, you know, my brother-in-law got ripped off by a used car dealer, and so we're going to pass a law that regulates used car dealers. This is a little bit different because there is a criminal case involving his relative pending at the time that this law passes.
Yeah.
And the defense attorney was directly involved in it. I haven't seen that happen in my time covering the legislature. He says the law wasn't retroactive. And it's true. The law wasn't made retroactive. He could have made it explicitly retroactive to apply to this relative's case. But in the law, there is what is called the rule of lenity, which is when a law is changed during a criminal case, the benefit goes to the defendant. So it didn't have to be explicitly retroactive to impact this case.
And it did impact
the
case.
And it did impact the case because we have the defense attorney, we have the prosecutor, and we have the judge all saying in open court, on records that because the law was changed, yeah, the government changed its plea offer. That is a direct impact on this case. Now, another thing about that President Adams kind of glosses over a little bit is when these cases arise where you have a direct relationship to somebody who you're changing a law for, typically that's disclosed, as a conflict of interest. Yeah. And so, you know, if my brother-in-law got ripped off by the used car dealer and I'm sponsoring a bill to regulate used car dealers, I might feel compelled to say, hey, and by the way, my brother-in-law got ripped off by this used car dealer. Yeah. I think that's maybe not explicitly required, but I think implicitly sort of agreed upon by most legislators.
So what's the reaction been from lawmakers? We know there have been some Democratic state lawmakers who have suggested Adams should resign.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I think the reaction has been remarkably quiet. A lot of the Republican senators are lining up behind Senator Adams because he's powerful, and I think, you know, they respect him. The Democrats have, outside of Nate Bluin, Senator Nate Bluin, who called for his resignation, haven't made a peep. They haven't issued a statement. I asked them again yesterday if they had a statement, and they didn't.
Former lawmaker Brian King did say something, but as you said,
Former Representative Brian King, who's the chair of the Democratic Party, yeah, also said he should resign. It's interesting to note that Representative King voted for this bill, yeah, while he was a representative. Again, did he know that this provision was in there and why? Probably not, but it's, you know. But aside from that, it's been pretty quiet. Alliance for a Better Utah, which is a liberal advocacy group, gathered and wrote some letters. I think they had 150 people-ish show up to write letters demanding his resignation. On Sunday, there was a group of conservatives who was kind of notable.
Because, yeah, that's an interesting twist.
Yeah, they were upset that, you know, they think this was soft on child abuse, and are saying that they're gathering signatures calling on President Adams to either step down as Senate president or resign his seat and to repeal this Senate Bill 213. We'll see how that process goes. Again, the bill is going to be reassessed, according to Speaker Schultz, in the coming months. So we'll see what ends up happening with the bill. But considering that this has got national attention now, the local reaction from the politicians, at least, has been pretty muted. There haven't been calls for an ethics investigation or anything like that. And so it's kind of maybe running its course.
I do think it's interesting that the House sponsor of the bill, Carrie-Anne Lisenby, has been troubled by the way this played out. She's been troubled by what happened. Just explain, she didn't really know that this was in her bill.
Yeah, yeah. So she was the House sponsor of Senator Cullimore's bill. She presented it, on the floor of the House, and she said when I asked her if she knew the genesis of this bill, if she knew about the case involving Stewart's relative, and if she knew that, you know, that was what the origin of it was, she said she didn't know any of that, and she didn't know that it was weakening the punishment for child rape. She said, based on her track record, which is pretty tough on crime, that if she had known that, she would have had that removed from the bill. Now, to be clear, Senator Cullimore disputes that and says that she was in the loop on what the language did. But she wants to, you know, have a discussion about it, and she says she wants to repeal it during the upcoming legislative session. So it's a topic that will continue to be discussed for coming months.
So what do you think is going to happen? It seems like the rule – is it clear whether that rule will be changed back? It'll go back to the other way? Or what do you think is going to happen?
Oh, Senator Adams and Senator Cullimore are pretty powerful people. Yeah. You've got the two most powerful people in the Senate who were the impetus for the passage of this law. To get them to roll that back when they both continue to say that they think that the policy was right, I think that's going to be a real hard push. Representative Lisenby wants it repealed, but you need to get it through both the House and the Senate, and those two leaders are in a position where they can stop anything that they don't want to allow to go through. So it'll be an interesting discussion. Now, the alternative outcome might be that they don't want the headache of this every time this issue comes up, reviving this whole story about how they got this bill passed in the first place. So we'll have to wait and see, I suppose.
Robert Gerke, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, Doug.
Robert Gerke, he's a politics reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. We have links to all of his reporting on this story on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last year, Utah lawmakers passed a bill that changed how the state handles certain sexual offenses involving teens. The law reduced the charges for cases where an 18-year-old high school student engages in sexual contact with a minor who cannot legally consent. Now, at the time, this part of the law didn't get that much attention, but all of that changed when early this month, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke revealed that Senate President Stuart Adams had a personal connection to that issue, a sexual abuse case involving his granddaughter. Adams says he kept his distance from the legislative process and he didn't vote on that particular amendment, but it raises questions of whether he crossed a line and abused his power. Recently, University of Utah law professor and former federal judge Paul Cassell has weighed in on the story. He wrote an op-ed defending Senator Adams in the Tribune. Cassell talked with us this week, and he said, this isn't a case of political interference. It's a citizen legislator doing what the system was designed to allow.
I thought it was very unfair the way Senator Adams was being treated here. This is the kind of thing that goes on frequently in the legislature. In fact, I've frequently gone to the legislature on behalf of crime victims or criminal justice reform, and I've highlighted an issue, and it's not uncommon to have legislators say, well, I have a family member that has seen something similar to that, or I have a constituent who was just telling me about that problem. And so if we're going to disable legislators from responding to problems that affect their families or their friends, I think that's going to ultimately lead to a process that's worse for all of the citizens in Utah. And so that's why I felt like perhaps I was uniquely situated to respond, because I do a lot of work with crime victims and I'm very sensitive to the victimization that occurred in this case. But there still has to be a balance in the process between, you know, how do we protect the victim and how do we also be fair to the defendant in a criminal case?
One of the things you mentioned in your piece is that the story's been distorted. So let's talk about the particular points you make. There's a larger principle that you mentioned about the role of being a citizen legislator, and we'll get back to that here in a moment. But let's talk about the case you make that Senator Adams didn't, in fact, abuse his power. Make the case.
Sure. Well, I think it's important to look at the facts. As I understand the facts now, it was a step-granddaughter of Senator Adams who was facing first-degree felony charges. Let's understand, and I'm sure your listeners are aware, we're talking about sexual abuse here, so I want to sort of give that upfront disclosure. But yeah. The nature of the crime here was that I was going to say a girl, but to be legally precise, a young woman who was 18 years and a couple of months, was a senior in high school, had sexual intercourse with an eighth grader who was 13. And so that is defined in Utah law as rape of a child. And the question then becomes, what possible sentence should she be looking at? And at the time, the prosecutors charged, as I understand it, a first-degree felony that was creating the possibility of a penalty of a mandatory 25 years in prison to life. Mm. And that, I think we need to understand, is just extraordinary. There are, in fact, many Americans who have been convicted of murder who are not looking at anything like 25 to life. And so the penalties here were just, I think it's fair to say, off the chart. And again, I'm not saying she didn't commit a crime, but I am saying we have to have a criminal justice system that meets out proportionate and deserved penalties. And if it doesn't do that, I think it calls the whole system into disrepute. So as I understand the facts, Senator Adams was familiar with this 25 to life prison sentence, mentioned it to one of his colleagues, Senator Cullimore, said, you might want to look into this. It does seem like this is out of whack. And eventually legislation was proposed through the ordinary process that would give prosecutors an option to divert from that 25 to life prison term for situations where there was a high school 18-year-old that had not yet graduated. I think when we start discussing this issue and abuse of power and some of the other things that have been thrown around, the first question I wanted to ask about the case is, well, by golly, what did the legislature do here? Oh, they got rid of a mandatory 25-year prison sentence for an 18-year-old defendant who had non-forcible sex with someone who was in eighth grade? That seems to me to be a perfectly appropriate change. And then we can start talking about what was the process that led to that.
One of the things you say in your article is that the legislation in question didn't apply to the case in question. What do you mean by that?
So the bill was designed to be prospective. Ordinarily, when the legislature passes a law on, let's say, May 1st, if it's signed by the governor, then that affects the law in the state of Utah on May 2nd and thereafter. Occasionally, the legislature will say, well, this is such an urgent situation. We want to have the law apply retroactively to conduct that occurred earlier. This law was not retroactive, so it didn't apply to Senator Adams's relative, which if you're trying to make a case for abuse of power, I think you'd want to know, well, did Senator Adams have involvement in legislation that directly benefited a relative? And the answer here is no, because it did not directly benefit his relative. There was no retroactivity to the law, and so it didn't apply. And just to press on that point even a little bit more, ultimately, Senator Adams's relative did not plead to the new third-degree felony that was created in this law. She pled guilty to a second-degree felony. Mm. So it's even harder to make the case that this somehow directly benefited Senator Adams's relative.
But Professor, pretty much everyone involved in that plea agreement and the case said the law was critical in resolving the charges against the senator's relative. Robert Gerke reported that in court hearings, like on the record, the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense attorney all said that this legislation did affect the outcome of the case. The defense attorney, Kara Tungaro, she told the judge at the sentencing that they all saw the legislative change. They all agreed it wasn't retroactive, but she said, and here's the quote, the government did change their offer based on that. What do you make of that?
So let's back up to the point I was making just a moment ago, and let's take what I think many Utahns will say is an uncontested fact, or at least an appropriate fact. 25 years in prison as a mandatory prison term for this case is not an appropriate outcome. And so if that was the point that was hanging up the plea negotiations, that prosecutors had charged this incredibly severe penalty, if that's the kind of outcome that was being bandied about, to have a defense attorney say, well, look, I don't really think 15 years, 25 years prison sentence is the right outcome. And here's some evidence of that, the recent legislative action. I don't see that as being, what's the phrase, abuse of power or something like that. That's just providing an argument for the defense attorney to say, I think this is an unfair outcome. And here's some evidence to show you that these extremely harsh penalties are an unfair outcome, the recent legislative action. So society evolves, legislatures pass laws, different things are available for attorneys to make arguments. I don't see that as somehow an improper part of the process. If the judge and the prosecutors were able to say, well, now we have a better sense of where the community in Utah is, the citizenry in Utah are on these issues of how long should the prison sentences be for these kinds of crimes. I mean, that's a good thing. That means that justice is now going to be meted out in the case in a way that reflects the current attitudes of the state.
So you don't think it matters that the legislation in question would not have happened if there hadn't been that particular case in question? If President Adams had not been motivated by the case, he wouldn't have approached Senator Cullimore and told him about the situation with his relative and said, look into this issue.
I think your point is correct, and I think your point is a commonplace. It's frequently the case that a legislator learns from a family member, a friend, a business acquaintance about a problem in society, and the legislator says, okay, let's go fix this. And then the problem is fixed. I don't think that we want to live in a state where legislators become disabled from responding to problems that are called to their attention. Now, there is a connection here to Senator Adams that is closer than, let's say, a business acquaintance or another constituent acquaintance, but that's just a question of degree. I don't think it's a question in kind. And so Senator Adams, by the way, he didn't vote on any of the substantive bills changing the law. He simply pointed out to Senator Cullimore that this seems to be a problem. Maybe you should look into this. It was then included in a bill. Some people have said, oh, it was snuck into the bill. If you look on the Utah.gov website, you'll see the bill. It is a longer bill, I think 15 or 20 pages, but there's a synopsis of the bill right on the front page with, I think it's 6 or 7 bullet points. This is one of the first bullet points, changing the law for 18-year-old high school students who have committed a non-forcible crime. It would change the possible penalties that could be used. So this wasn't something that was, you know, snuck in the dark of night that nobody was aware of. This was straightforward legislation of the legislature responding to a problem and fixing it.
What is it that would constitute an abuse of power if this doesn't, as you see it? You say the fact that Senator Adams was personally affected by something that he saw in a law shouldn't disqualify him from trying to, you know, do something about it legislatively. But don't you think he could have gone about this in a better way? Adams said that no other legislator knew of his connection to the issue. He said that, here's what he wrote in a statement, thus that case could not have influenced their decision to vote in favor or against the bill. But in fact, shouldn't he have disclosed that? Why not just disclose that? Isn't there a better way to go about this? If he sees a problem in this law, it's disturbing, and it just so happens to also be personally affecting a relative of his, why not just go about it through the normal process and disclose all of this and just go through it that way? So what do you make of that argument?
Yeah, so let's circle into what I think is something that hasn't been generally pointed out in the debate. There is a Utah statute on disclosure of direct conflicts of interest.
Yeah.
In the Utah Code, but most of those provisions deal with financial conflicts of interest. And so what would constitute an abuse of power, I think, was one of the points you were circling in on.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume that a senator or representative had a business and then passed a law that specifically favored those kinds of businesses over other businesses in Utah. And the financial advantage that would accrue to the legislature from that law was not disclosed. That seems to me to be the kind of thing that would be creating a conflict of interest and should be disclosed and might constitute an abuse of power if it was deliberately not disclosed. But now we start to circle into a couple of things here that I think take this outside of the abuse of power category. One is that Senator Adams did not disclose his connection because he was afraid that it might influence others to vote in favor of the law. So it's sort of darned if you do, darned if you don't. I suppose he said, well, this is, you know, I've got a family connection here and the bill goes through, as I suspect it would have, because it made so much sense when you look at the, you know, the level of the severe penalties. He would be accused of throwing his weight around. Instead, he elected not to disclose what was going on. He did not vote on the legislation in question. So I don't see this as being the type of thing that constitutes an abuse of power.
I guess I want to keep coming back to the fact that it may not have directly impacted his relative, but it seems like it indirectly did benefit his relative. Don't you concede that point?
It certainly sounds like you can make that case, that indirectly that helped to change the plea bargain to the favorability of Senator Adams' relative. But what we talk about here in the law school a lot of times is what's known as the slippery slope. So let's assume that we're now going to say anytime a legislator in the Utah legislature is involved in legislation that would indirectly benefit, what, a relative, a friend, a constituent, they're now engaged in what's the phrase, abuse of power if they actually move forward with that? I mean, that just seems like a recipe for hamstringing the legislature. Every single bill on, for example, taxes is going to have an indirect effect on a legislator and a legislator's family members. Every bill on public education is going to involve indirectly any legislator who happens to have, you know, a family member in our system of public education. I don't mean to exaggerate, but I don't think I am. If the test is indirectly benefit a relative or what, friend or family member of a legislator, the legislature would spend the entire 45 days disclosing potential indirect conflicts of interest. There are trade-offs here, and that's why I'm pleased to see that you're devoting so much time to this issue, because as I've discussed the Senator Adams case with some of my colleagues and friends, the more they learn about the case, the more surprised they are that there's such a controversy about it.
Let's come finally to the end, to the larger sort of point that you make about the nature of citizen legislatures. As you mentioned, citizen legislators, you say, must remain free to propose fixing unfair laws whenever and however they learn about them. So there's a larger principle at stake here for you.
There is. And yeah, let me just unpack that a little bit, because I think it's an interesting point. You can categorize state legislatures around the country into different types. And we're what's known as a citizen legislature because the folks that are in our legislature, they work for about 45 days in the legislative session, and then they return to their professions and go back to their communities and learn about how society is operating from that vantage point. If you go to larger states, such as, for example, New York and California, there you have professional legislators. They basically spend all year round working on legislation. They're surrounded by very large staffs, dare I say, very large bureaucracies that consider what types of bills should be proposed and what areas should be addressed. And we're in a different mode out here in Utah. And so there are advantages and disadvantages to that. But one of the advantages that stems from citizen legislatures is that the legislatures are in the community. They see the fullness of human life, the good things that are going on, the bad things that are going on, and they can then respond to that by proposing legislation. And so I think it is important that our legislators remain free to respond to someone. You know, they're at Chuckarama and somebody comes up and says, hey, Senator, I'm smiling because you may know that I did some work with Senator Hatch back in the day, and he was famous for going to Chuckarama. And he was also famous for being buttonholed at Chuckarama by his constituents. And I think one of the things Senator Hatch has always been remembered for is how friendly he was to people who would come up. And I'm sure that there were occasions where somebody called to his attention a problem that he then, you know, addressed back in D.C. And I think we want our legislators here in the state of Utah to be able to do that as well. And this controversy you see that has surrounded Senator Adams, I think, interestingly, I do a lot of work with crime victims, but the people who I think should be most afraid about what's going on here should be defense attorneys and others who are concerned about fair treatment of criminal defendants in the process. I mean, my goodness, look what happened to the controversy here to Senator Adams when he proposed a bill that made a very, frankly, modest adjustment to our penalties for child sexual abuse. Can you imagine what the next defense-oriented bill is going to look like? I mean, there are going to be people running out of the room when somebody is proposing a change that reduces penalties in this area. And that's exactly not the way we want our process to work. We want people to be able to candidly discuss, is the right penalty here 5 years or 15 years or 25 years? You know, we can't lock up every offender for 25 years to life. We'll bankrupt the state in a very short period of time. And it's going to become more and more difficult to have these hard discussions about where are we going to be investing resources in prisons and other criminal justice devices and procedures if legislators aren't free to speak about this and not having to worry that the next afternoon they're going to see a news story about how they love child rapists or something like that. So that, I think, is the larger principle that's at stake here. And I'm hopeful that the more people learn about the situation, the more they'll understand that there really is not anything to the allegation that there was an abuse of power here.
Professor Paul Cassell, thank you very much.
You bet. Always nice talking with you, Doug.
That's Paul Cassell. He's a distinguished professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law here at the University of Utah. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.